For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. House Speaker Tim Moore said Thursday that he'd like to give teachers raises this year, but called a proposal for a 10% increase unrealistic. The News and Observer reports that's the amount Superintendent of Public Instruction June Atkinson suggested as a base pay increase Wednesday at a House Select Committee meeting. Raising all public school teachers' salaries by 10% would cost the state close to $540 million. Moore told the same committee a 2% raise proposed in the House budget last year was more likely to be considered. Any increase has to be negotiated with the Senate. The U.S. economy's growth slowed sharply in the final 3 months of 2015 to a 0.7% annual rate. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The reasons for the slowdown? Consumers reduced spending, businesses cut back on investment, and global problems trimmed exports. The government's estimate of the economy's expansion in the October-December period was the weakest showing since a severe winter reduced growth to a 0.6% annual rate in last year's first quarter. Activity should rebound in the current January to March period, though economists worry that China's troubles and sinking oil and stock prices could dampen the recovery. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Fox News says it was not about to contribute $5 million to Donald Trump's charities in order to get Trump to take part in last night's Republican presidential debate. Fox says although Trump had said he was going to boycott the debate because of his feud with the network, he also said he would have shown up had Fox made the donation. Trump held his own rally last night in Iowa, just a few miles from where the Fox News debate was being held. The Trump campaign says the frontrunner's rally raised $6 million for veterans. Meanwhile, the other Republican presidential candidates targeted Trump anyway at the Fox News Channel debate in Iowa. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush joked about Trump's absence.
I kind of miss Donald Trump. He was a little teddy bear to me. We always had such a loving relationship during these debates and in between and the tweets. I kind of miss him. I wish he was here. Everybody else was in the witness protection program when I went after him on behalf of what the Republican cause should be. Conservative principles, believing in limited government, believing in accountability.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's neck and neck with Trump for the lead in Iowa, when asked about the absence of his GOP rival, answered with his best impersonation of the Donald.
Let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Senator Marco Rubio says Donald Trump should not be the focus of the presidential campaign.
It's not about Donald Trump. He's an entertaining guy. He's the greatest show on earth. This campaign is about the greatest country in the world and a president who has systematically destroyed many of the things that made America special.
Retired neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson said he's proud he's not a career politician.
You're not going to hear a lot of polished political speech from me, but you will hear the truth. And I don't think you have to be a politician to tell the truth. In fact, sometimes it's not that way around.
Ohio Governor John Kasich added he believes in finding common ground and not encouraging political divisions.
We cannot fix the things in this country, the Social Security, the border, balancing the budget, getting wages to grow faster, unless we lead as conservatives, but we also invite people in from the other party. We have to come together as a country.
While New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said American voters don't care about inside politics, they want a leader who can get things done.
That's the difference between being a governor and having done that for the last 6 years in New Jersey and being someone who has never had to be responsible for any of those decisions. Barack Obama was never responsible for those decisions. Hillary Clinton has never been responsible for those kind of decisions.
And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul didn't hesitate to remind the public about the conduct of former President Bill Clinton and how that reflects on Democratic contention. Hillary Clinton.
She can't be a champion of women's rights at the same time she's got this that is always lurking out there, this type of behavior. So it is difficult.
Of her husband's.
Yeah, but I combine this also with the millions upon millions of dollars they've taken from regimes in the Middle East who treat women like cattle.
Iowa voters kick off the 2016 nominating process Monday, offering the first indications of whether Trump's abrupt decision to skip the debate will have any impact on his standing atop the GOP field. Youth homelessness, property insurance rates, and the state's rainy day fund are subjects North Carolina lawmakers intend to study before the legislature convenes in April or the next session begins in January 2017. Lawmakers comprising the Legislative Research Commission met yesterday and approved six study topics. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now it's time to find out what matters with Chad Adams.
Please stand by.
We now take you live to the Institute of Rational Thought for a special broadcast. Hard-hitting interviews and relevant information to make your day. It's Chad Adams.
Good afternoon, folks. Friday it is. Fun show for you today. Glad to have you with us. Beautiful Friday. Looks like a gorgeous weekend. All global warming jokes aside, looks like it's going to be just a wonderful, wonderful, spectacular weekend, regardless of where you hail from in the state of North Carolina. For those of you listening in other states, we appreciate you. We do. I'm constantly, as I was reviewing the folks listening on podcast, I'm amazed. I mean, when you get over 1,000 people listening on a podcast, that's amazing. Not to count the hundreds and actually over 1,000 that are listening between repeats of the show and regular show. So thank you. Welcome. Glad to have you here. If you're listening on a recorded show, hope the weather's still nice, regardless of when you're listening. Now it is, if you're listening live, it's between 3 and 4 PM right now, 3:06 PM Eastern Standard Time. When we're getting on with things, have a real interesting show for you today. And, you know, as always, we're bringing you a lot of fun guests. Lieutenant Governor's going to be joining us, I believe, Monday. That's also fun. Still working out details with the governor's office. Hopefully we'll be able to get him on his staff. I guess they're very busy in campaign mode. David Bossie, president of Citizens United, one of the largest political action groups out there, very active in this election cycle. He's joining us today. In fact, coming up in a couple minutes, Dr. Andrew Taylor from NC State, our political science guy, guru, talking about what happened. It was the seven guys beating up on Trump and each other. It was just a free for all. I'm trying to make it more salient for every one of you. We're going to get kind of an insider discussion, a much calmer discussion than we saw unfold in the spectacle that was last night's free-for-all, it seemed like. And then Tim Boyum, our wrap-up, News 14 Carolina. Always a pleasure to have Tim in here and talk about, you know, he gets to speak to you in 3, 5, 6 minute segments. We get him for 30 minutes, but to just talk to you. Because a lot of the stuff that you see on the news, you don't see the whole story. You see pieces of it. So talking with Tim, we have a lot of fun, a lot of behind. You get to peek behind the curtain of the way in which news comes to you. You get to hear from someone in the media, and we're very pleased to have the relationships that we have with those in the media, as they might say, or at least to those, maybe those that went through. I'm not going to give public education that hard a time. Now, it wasn't that long ago. In fact, it was about an hour ago or so that Governor Pat McCrory had a huge victory in the North Carolina Supreme Court. There was an ongoing battle, largely, you know, it was a battle at the time about who has the right to appoint members to a given committee. And the governor was saying, we do. The legislature saying, we do. So this ends up, I mean, the real shame of it is that taxpayers are having to fund both sides, but at least we get some clarification. Elliot Engstrom from Closing Arguments, if you were listening to the show prior to this one, he was discussing this because it kind of happened in real time. Mark Binker has it up over at WRAL.com. North Carolina lawmakers tried to take too much power out of the hands of Governor McCrory when they created a trio of commissions, including one that oversees coal ash cleanup. A divided state Supreme Court ruled on Friday. In the specific showdown over appointments to the three boards, six justices sided with the governor, saying that lawmakers had violated the Constitution's separation of powers clause. The seven-member court stopped short of handing McCrory a total victory that would have prevented any legislative branch appointments to board carrying out executive branch functions. Still, the ruling could have consequences in future cases that challenge the authority of other state boards and commissions. When the General Assembly appoints executive officers that the governor has little power to remove, it can appoint them essentially without the governor's influence, the court found. That leaves the governor with little control over the views and priorities of the officers that the General Assembly appoints. Without influence over the appointees to the relevant commissions, the court found, the governor could not carry out his responsibilities to protect the state's environment or effectively carry out other executive functions. While we are disappointed, we respect the court's responsibility to resolve these constitutional questions and will carefully review the ruling and determining the next steps necessary to comply. A joint statement from House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate President Tim Filburger. In other words, the governor had a huge victory over the legislature today. Now, depending on your perspective, that's interesting. At least we're resolving that the executive branch has executive authority. The lawsuit represented an unusually strident conflict between McCrory, a Republican, and Republican lawmakers. Joining McCrory in the suit were former Governors Jim Hunt, a Democrat, Jim Martin, a Republican. So there you go. This is very, very interesting to see what the repercussions of this will be. Associate Justice Paul Newby and many folks out there of the justices, nobody, I know many of them. Paul Newby works and has worked as hard as any justice ever in getting votes and running statewide campaigns. Very popular, very well known. He was the one that dissented from the rest of the justices. He said that lawmakers were within their rights to determine how commissions like the Coal Ash Management Group should be filed. To overturn a law of the people acting through the General Assembly, the court must find an express constitutional violation beyond a reasonable doubt, Newby said in the dissenting opinion. So, this what happens now, the real question now is, so McCrory gets his victory, how many boards and commissions will get realigned vis-a-vis the governor's oversight of those boards and commission? There are major consequences with this decision. It remains to be seen how far the governor's office will take it and whether or not this will be an issue. Now, the interesting thing also, could the General Assembly just change the laws? They can. We have a very powerful General Assembly. So we will see. just very interesting. And also breaking news that was happening while Elliot's show was going on, as we were preparing for today's show, and there's a lot to cover here, but we're not going to get to some of it, obviously. This is interesting because we know, and this is way outside of North Carolina, but it could have repercussions within North Carolina, is that Hillary Clinton, I think, is one of the most ethically and legally challenged people that have ever run for president. I've kind of withheld a lot of my thoughts on this because we focus primarily on North Carolina. I got a lot of questions yesterday about, you know, how I feel about various presidential candidates. We'll probably get into that later in this show because I've tried to just give you information. I have many opinions about this. But this, the situation with Hillary Clinton's email server, I know it's not sexy to a lot of people. I know it drives the liberal left crazy. They just can't believe. But it is serious. And had any of us done what she did, it's almost treasonous. These are the highest level secrets that are exposed on an email server that's not within the confines of government. This is a serious effect. We don't know how many lives it affected. We don't know what was affected. And here's the staggering thought. The Obama administration confirmed for the first time Friday that Hillary Clinton's unsecured home server contained some of the most closely guarded U.S. government secrets. They censored 22 emails with material demanding one of the highest levels of classification. The revelation comes just 3 days before the Iowa presidential nominating caucus in which Clinton is a candidate. The State Department will release its next batch of emails from Clinton's time as Secretary of State later Friday today. But the AP has learned that 7 email chains are being withheld in full because they contain information to be top secret. Now, the irony here is, so we, the U.S. public, can't see these, but all of the other governments who could have had access to her unsecured server has them, most likely. Do you see this alone from a decision-making standpoint? The Clinton email problem is huge. She's vying to be commander-in-chief, and the fact that she thought it was even a remotely good idea to have these emails on an unsecured server with the nation's most closely guarded secrets shows a lack of ability to understand what the executive office does. She's completely bereft. And again, I haven't beat up on Hillary Clinton because, again, we focus primarily on North Carolina, but it just shows a profound lack of contact with reality. It's just staggeringly so. Staggeringly so. So, I'm just blown away. This, it is big. It is important. And the Sanders camp should make hay of this. And you know what? This is, to me, there's so much irony in these presidential campaigns. It's so interesting. Democrats that support Hillary are essentially telling you, me, the rest of the country, they don't care about top secrets. They don't care about the fact that this could endanger our men and women in uniform and in other places. It also means they don't care about, what about operatives that are working with the U.S. government whose covers could get blown? What about special operations that all of a sudden our enemies have copies of emails about operations that are ongoing. They could, again, endanger the lives of Americans. What the Democrats that are supporting Hillary, it is dog. That means that their support of her is just dogmatic. It is just that they don't care about facts. They have a blind faith that they're okay. If she released facts that endangered American lives, there anybody that supports Hillary, boom, that's the belief system. Now, the people on the right have plenty of dogmatic stuff. I mean, when I watch the free-for-all outside, people that are wed to a given candidate, they're just wed. It's almost a team sport. It's almost detached from philosophy. I've got a great column by Charles Krauthammer that we will get into later. I think Krauthammer is still arguably one of the brightest minds in political thought today. I think, I don't always agree with him, but most of the time I do. I love reading his writings. I love reading George Will's writings. Haven't read any George Will in some time now. But Krauthammer is spot on in his observations about kind of more of what I've just discussed, about kind of the unhinged way in which many people are looking at this presidential election. And it is interesting. And he's not real friendly to Trump, but that's not a surprise. But we will have, again, we're supposed to be joined shortly by our folks from Citizen United. And looking forward to that. We're going to take a quick break right now. I think we have something. I want this next one. We should have an ad about the good old folks at Civitas and this wonderful, wonderful conservative leadership conference, because I think there's been a change or two with it. But so we're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be right back, hopefully, with our buddy from Citizen United, David Bossie.
Attention, conservatives. Don't miss your chance to hear from former Congressman Colonel Alan West, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, Ann McElhaney, and Dinesh D'Souza March 4th and 5th. The Civitas Institute invites you to the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference in Raleigh. Get your tickets online at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. Join the Civitas Institute and hundreds of fellow conservatives to hear from inspiring leaders and dynamic speakers from the Heritage Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, the Civitas Institute, and many more. Go to CivitasCLC.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. It's time to stand up for the principles that made our country great. Learn how at the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference, March 4th and 5th at the Embassy Suites by Hilton Raleigh-Durham Research Triangle in Cary. Register at CivitasCLC.com or call 919-834-2099. That's 919-834-2099.
Good afternoon. Joining us now via phone, not in studio, because he's a busy guy. He's all over the country. David Bossie, president of Citizens United, a guy at the helm of one of the most, one of the largest Supreme Court free speech cases a couple of years back that kind of set the tone for many elections. But Citizens United still very active out there. David, welcome to the show. How are you?
I am very well. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, most people have kind of, if you were to mention Citizens United, they have a vague recollection of the court case. Wait a minute. Wasn't that,
right?
What was that? Was it Wisconsin? They have kind of in their head a thought process or two about it.
Sure.
But tell us.
I find that. Thanks for asking. You know, that's a great way to start. Most people, they hear Citizens United, and if they know it, they know it because Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton have attacked us over the last several years so many times, and that's usually how people acknowledge us. We have been around almost 30 years. Citizens United was founded in 1988, and we really have been very proud to be one of the nation's largest conservative organizations. We're a very robust, what we call the Reagan three legs of the stool conservative organization. So we're not a single issue group. Citizens United has a strong foreign policy component, economic and social policy component. So we're very much kind of that Reagan-esque theme in America.
Now, I love how a guy with your personality, which is very gregarious, very outgoing, I love this kind of humility you have. You're masking something else that you didn't even mention. You have released 21 feature-length documentaries. You didn't even mention that. That's huge.
Well, one of the things we do here, and one of the things we recognize, and that really what got us to the United States Supreme Court, is we write a lot of policy papers, a lot of op-eds. I've written many books. And many years ago, in 2004, we saw the success of Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, a film that really, you know, made me very upset, and I disagreed with the content of that film. But I recognized that as conservatives, we didn't have anyone on our side that could do the same thing, meaning produce conservative film for the American people. And so that's what we decided to do. So we've been making conservative films with Newt Gingrich, with Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, you name the conservative leader in America, and we make films with them or have them in them as part of it. And so we've been doing that now for the last 10 years. And it was in 2007, our film on Hillary Clinton called Hillary. The Movie. Hillary the Movie. And there was a film that we tried to put out on her, just like Michael Moore put out his anti-Bush film.
Yep.
And we were told by the Federal Election Commission it was a violation of McCain-Feingold, it was a violation of the federal law, and if we did that, that I and other officers of my corporation here would be charged not civilly but criminally. And it was a 5 years in prison per count. And I literally sat back and I scratched my head as I sat across the table from these government lawyers, and I could not believe that they're threatening what we were as a political organization, but we're making a documentary film on somebody running for president,
yeah.
Kind of the backbone of what you think is covered under the First Amendment, and it was not covered at all from the government's point of view. So they threatened to arrest us if we did it. And so I said to them, look, you know, we're not going to stand around and worry about whether you're coming after us. We are going to sue you. And they literally laughed at me. I remember it like it was yesterday. In 2007, they literally laughed at me because they said, "Oh no, no, you little man, you try to take us on, and we'll put you in your place." And so we did. We sued them. That's why the case is Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, and not the other way around. We were on offense. I filed suit because I was not going to do anything that was obviously going to get me in that type of trouble. And we went all the way to the Supreme Court and had a victory, not after one argument, but we ended up having to have a second re-argument before the Supreme Court. And it was only in a 5-4 decision where the government contended that they could ban our film and other films like it, as well as books. The government actually contended in open court at the Supreme Court that they could ban books, that the federal government had the power to ban books. And I got to tell you, as I sat there in the courtroom at the Supreme Court, I felt like I won the case right then and there when the government had to make that. It was very dramatic. I actually was sitting right next to John McCain and Russ Feingold when that happened. It was actually
What First Amendment?
Yeah.
Come on.
And I'll tell you right now, I was shocked that there were four members of the Supreme Court who actually agreed with that, because we only won 5-4 in what became 4 days later an infamous case, because Barack Obama went to the well during his State of the Union, and that was where he attacked, really for the first time in American history, the Supreme Court sitting in front of him as a captive audience, not able to respond. And that's where Justice Alito, if you remember, famously mouthed the words, "not true, not true,"
yeah,
because the president was making an allegation against them. And so that was our case, and we've been producing films ever since, and we will have a film out on Hillary Clinton later this year, which I can happily say I'm not going to be threatened with.
Well, you're allowed? Wait, you're allowed?
Yeah, if you can imagine that.
Is it Hillary the Movie 2?
It is Hillary the Sequel.
Coming to an unsecured server near you.
That's exactly right. Very well done. So, you know, and by the way, you could see today, just now, moments ago.
Yes.
The federal court has said they're going to put out another 1,000 pages. But for the first time, the government, the White House, is now acknowledging there's dozens of top secret level emails that are on her server, and that is going to pose an enormous problem.
Well, I love it. They're censoring 22 emails with material demanding one of the highest levels of classification. I find it fascinating, as we said right before you came on air, I said, this is just kind of funny. I said, because, oh, yeah, the American public isn't allowed to see it, but every enemy of the state could have picked it off an unsecured server. So, yeah, our enemies
Russia,
can see
Iran,
it.
Iran, they've all seen it. Look, if somebody wanted to go pay them, they probably could provide us with all of these.
Wouldn't it be great if Breitbart or something like that came up and said, we actually have those emails already. We didn't get them from our country. But, yeah, you know, the Iranians shipped a copy of them over today.
Right. And one of the things that we do in our litigation efforts, and we've been doing this now for about 2 years, we've been filing Freedom of Information Act cases with the State Department, and that is really gotten us. It's been basically Citizens United, Vice News, and Judicial Watch. The three of us, as really the only ones out there, the watchdog groups that are out there trying to force this. So this is from one of those cases that Vice News did. That's today's case. But I think we have about 40 FOIA cases, about a dozen active cases at the court at different levels. We are constantly on a weekly basis getting documents from the State Department, and we put them out continuously because we feel it's the American people's right to know what Hillary Clinton and how Clinton Inc. really was working with her at the State Department and the foundation, and really their worldwide cabal, if you will, of how Bill and Hillary Clinton really fleeced the American people and using the crony capitalism that we all talk about today.
Right.
They are the embodiment of it.
They're the masters of it. Now, and again, most of what we focus on our show has to do with North Carolina. We're going to pivot there in a second. It's funny because they're like the WikiLeaks of the State Department. I mean, the Clintons and really, you wonder why Julian Assange, hey, he should come back, hold a press conference, say, look, you know, she's got much more sensitive stuff than I ever had.
That's right. So it's been an amazing thing to watch, and it could end up being her downfall. I mean, the every time there's a story about one of these emails that comes out, whether it's ours or Judicial Watch or the Vice News, the FBI is reading the same story, but they're using it as a lead and as a piece of evidence to continue their work. And that's much more important, really, for me, because I served as the chief investigator for Congress. So I led all of the Clinton investigations in the 90s, from Whitewater through the campaign finance investigation all the way through the impeachment. So I really know most of these people incredibly well. Cheryl Mills, I think we deposed her 3 or 4 times in the 90s. So it's a pretty amazing thing to see all of these Clinton cronies come back again.
Well, it is. Now, pivoting over to North Carolina, You guys also look at congressional races and other things, and you're starting to look at North Carolina. Tell me what you guys are looking at in North Carolina.
Well, there's really two races in North Carolina. One is, I'm just going to tell you, Renee Elmers has been nationally, just an enormous disappointment. She came to Washington as really running as a change agent, running as somebody who was going to come and make a difference in Washington for the people of her district in North Carolina, somebody who was really even embraced the Tea Party movement and ran as a conservative. And the first thing she did when she got here was the congresswoman really just turned her vote card over to John Boehner and Kevin McCarthy and really became the embodiment of the establishment and what was wrong with Washington, not how to change Washington. And so we have been watching, what she's done and how she's been doing it for the last several years. We did not get involved in the race in 2014, I believe. That's when the candidates...
she had a primary with one candidate, Frank Roach.
With Frank Roach.
But you got involved this time. Is this the only one you're getting involved in North Carolina?
This is the only House race at the moment.
Wow. And you've endorsed somebody in that race?
We're endorsing Jim Duncan
wow.
in that race against Renee Elmers. We feel that he is somebody with a background, with a history, and somebody whose character we feel will just represent that district, the second district in North Carolina, incredibly well, and I'm proud to say that we're supporting Jim Duncan.
Well, David, we're running short on time, but thank you for being a part of our broadcast today. We want to get you back on again soon, all right? A lot going on.
Would love to do that. Thank you. Anytime.
Citizens United's president, David Bossy. We try to bring you these are interesting folks, and we've got much more to go here. Our good buddy, Professor Taylor, coming up next as a recap of the Fox News debate last night. Stay tuned.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. House Speaker Tim Moore said Thursday that he'd like to give teachers raises this year, but called a proposal for a 10% increase unrealistic. The News and Observer reports that's the amount Superintendent of Public Instruction June Atkinson suggested as a base pay increase Wednesday at a House Select Committee meeting. Raising all public school teachers' salaries by 10% would cost the state close to $540 million. Moore told the same committee a 2% raise proposed in the House budget last year was more likely to be considered. Any increase has to be negotiated with the Senate. The U.S. economy's growth slowed sharply in the final 3 months of 2015 to a 0.7% annual rate. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The reasons for the slowdown? Consumers reduced spending, businesses cut back on investment, and global problems trimmed exports. The government's estimate of the economy's expansion in the October-December period was the weakest showing since a severe winter reduced growth to a 0.6% annual rate in last year's first quarter. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Fox News says it was not about to contribute $5 million to Donald Trump's charities in order to get Trump to take part in last night's Republican presidential debate. Fox says although Trump had said he was going to boycott the debate because of his feud with the network, he also said he would have shown up had Fox made the donation. Trump held his own rally last night in Iowa, just a few miles from where the Fox News debate was being held. The Trump campaign says the frontrunner's rally raised $6 million for veterans. Meanwhile, the other Republican presidential candidates targeted Trump anyway at the Fox News Channel debate in Iowa. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush joked about Trump's absence.
I kind of miss Donald Trump. He was a little teddy bear to me. We always had such a loving relationship during these debates and in between and the tweets. I kind of miss him. I wish he was here. Everybody else was in the witness protection program when I went after him on behalf of what the Republican cause should be. Conservative principles, believing in limited government, believing in accountability.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's neck and neck with Trump for the lead in Iowa, when asked about the absence of his GOP rival, answered with his best impersonation of the Don.
Let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Senator Marco Rubio says Donald Trump should not be the focus of the presidential campaign.
It's not about Donald Trump. He's an entertaining guy. He's the greatest show on earth. This campaign is about the greatest country in the world and a president who has systematically destroyed many of the things that made America special.
Retired neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson said he's proud he's not a career politician.
You're not going to hear a lot of polished political speech from me, but you will hear the truth. And I don't think you have to be a politician to tell the truth. In fact, sometimes it's not that way around.
Ohio Governor John Kasich added he believes in finding common ground and not encouraging political divisions.
We cannot fix this things in this country, the Social Security, the border, balancing the budget, getting wages to grow faster, unless we lead as conservatives, but we also invite people in from the other party. We have to come together as a country.
While New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said American voters don't care about inside politics, they want a leader who can get things done.
That's the difference between being a governor and having done that for the last 6 years in New Jersey and being someone who has never had to be responsible for any of those decisions. Barack Obama was never responsible for those decisions. Hillary Clinton has never been responsible for those kind of decisions.
And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul didn't hesitate to remind the public about the conduct of former President Bill Clinton and how that reflects on Democratic contention. Hillary Clinton.
She can't be a champion of women's rights at the same time she's got this that is always lurking out there, this type of behavior. So it is difficult.
Of her husband's.
Yeah, but I combine this also with the millions of upon millions of dollars they've taken from regimes in the Middle East who treat women like cattle.
Iowa voters kick off the 2016 nominating process Monday, offering the first indications of whether Trump's abrupt decision to skip the debate will have any impact on his standing atop the GOP field. And it was a huge turnout at a Panthers Pride rally at a park in Uptown Charlotte today. Players, Sir Purr, the Top Cats, the percussion drumline, and the Black and Blue crew were all on hand for the pre-Super Bowl send-off event. The Panthers gave out more than 2,500 pom-poms and other team souvenirs to fans. The team leaves for California Sunday. They take on the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50, February 7th at 6:30 in Santa Clara. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with Chad Adams.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm having a great day. Every day above, and I used to say this and people would get mad. I would say every day above ground's a good day. And they would, oh, that sounds like a depressing thing. No, it's a celebration of life. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great thing to be alive. Wonderful day. May you live in interesting times, and we do. And Shatner emphasis added there. Right now, Professor Andrew Taylor with us from NC State, our political guru extraordinaire, and we're pleased to have him with us. How are you today?
Very well, thanks, Chad.
So did you want...
Not quite as chipper as you, apparently.
You're not? Well, what a shame. I mean, good, great. You work at NC State. Other than having a flawed basketball and football program, it's a great university.
There you go. Yeah. I feel happier now. Thank you.
Yeah, and they drive tractors into work. It's a great place to be. Now, turning our attention to last night, it was kind of an... To me, I had trouble watching it because it looked to me... Like a melee. I mean, it just, you know, they weren't, you know, I thought that at any moment fists would break out and it would just go into chaos. And Trump wasn't there. That's the thing. Yeah. I thought it would be more serene, but it was not. I mean, the commentators seemed to be just looking for any way to pitch these guys against one another. And what's your take on it?
Well, it did seem kind of incomplete, obviously, without Trump there, that it wasn't quite the whole story of the Republican presidential race. In the past, of course, it hasn't been the whole story because not all the candidates have been there, but they've been on an undercard debate, which we sort of have often felt safe in ignoring. But without Trump there, it just didn't feel like the entire action of the race was in one place at one time. Of course, he was just down the street, but nevertheless, he wasn't in the debate hall itself. And so, yes, I think that was the obvious part missing. You talked about the the conflict that remained, even though, you know, Trump's a pretty prickly character, as we all know, but there was still plenty of conflict even without him. I thought it was interesting, particularly early on, of course, when it did seem as though the knives were out for Ted Cruz, he pushed back against the moderator, saying that they'd kind of set him up at one stage, mocking Trump by saying, "Well, because everybody's piling on me, I think I'll leave." So it was interesting that Cruz had clearly sort of slipped into the Trump role and was the person that everybody was getting. But there was plenty of conflict and in sort of little dyads, in little pairwise conflicts between individual groups of couples of candidates. So I thought there was an interesting interaction, for example, between Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush on immigration. Rand Paul had an interesting back and forth with Cruz on immigration. It was still pretty feisty, even though the guy at the top of the polls wasn't there.
Now I want to get to that first, and I don't want to spend a lot of time there. But as I'm watching, as I'm tuning in, and I'm watching it, and this is no affectation for Trump, but it was odd to me because it was so glaring that he wasn't there. That's the part you kind of alluded to that. But so you're looking at this, it's clear the front runner, at least according to every possible way to measure it at this point in time, not there. And it was just odd. I mean, it did seem different to me. But am I just overly sensitive there, or did you pick up on it too? It was a difference.
Yeah, I think there was a difference. There's obviously a difference in the dynamics, Chad, as we just mentioned. There was a difference in the electricity, just in the room, and I think even you could feel it at home. without Trump there. For, you know, one obvious reason is because the guy in the lead in the polls is now a debate. That takes away, obviously, some of its value. And then the fact that the guy, you know, is so interesting to watch, and he wasn't there. So that took away from some of the value as well. So I think there was a sense, both at home, you know, your own anticipation on your own couch, that was gone a little bit. And you could feel that there wasn't quite as much electricity in the in the room itself than there had been in previous debates. Now, preliminary figures on the viewers is that it was down.
Well, see, I've got a different one, because the Hollywood Reporter is saying that Donald Trump may have been absent, but Thursday's night Republican debate on Fox News nevertheless scored an 8.4 rating, 12.5 million viewers.
It was still good. It was still good. It was up a bit on the Fox Business Network debate, but that's a largely a function of the fact that not as many people get Fox Business Network as get Fox News. But
Almost half as many as watched the first debate in August, though.
Right. But some of that's attributable to just sort of general attrition. I mean, not because Trump wasn't there. But what it does do is allow Trump to at least make a plausible case that, look, people aren't as interested in it when I'm not around. And I think that's whether you accept that argument or not, he's going to make it. And it is a plausible argument, because the figures were off from those high numbers we saw in the earlier Fox debate and the CNN debate.
Now, as I'm watching this, and with Trump not there, I expected it to be less visceral. I expected it to be more policy wonky. You know, you're not having these very open-ended, you know, Trump doesn't give a lot of detail. He kind of broadsides everything. But in this, you know, both the questions and even the there was clearly animosity that was on that stage, and it came out. I mean, there were some claws. It was like a cat fight at times. Did it seem that way to you?
Yeah, no, definitely. Particularly at the beginning, you know, with Cruz, there was some really acerbic attacks on him. He was obviously, at least in Iowa, and also nationally, although the lead over all the other candidates nationally is less than it is in Iowa, the person who was at top of the polls who had actually showed up. And so he kind of played the role of the person who gets piled on. His colleagues at the debate last night didn't let him down. I mean, they jumped on him immediately. You know, he said he accused Megyn Kelly and Bret Baier and Chris Wallace of setting him up and allowing the others to sort of jump on him. But it continued. It did continue, even when the questions weren't explicitly, you know, criticize another person or contrast your position with another person. Even the sort of more vanilla type questions solicited these kinds of attacks. So this is late in the day now, Chad. The stakes are very high. I think there's a real sense among some campaigns, in fact, all of the people who were there, that Monday in Iowa and then the following week in New Hampshire are huge. If things go against them, it's possibly they are done. Their opportunity to be president of the United States is over. You know, obviously Cruz is doing well in the polls in Iowa, but if Trump beats him in Iowa, given all that he staked on that state, it's an argument for that Cruz should be the nominee is greatly weakened. Kasich and Christie have a tremendous amount, and Bush really, although he obviously is more deep pocketed and has more financial support, they have a lot at stake in New Hampshire. Rubio really needs to make sure he comes third in Iowa and at least second in New Hampshire, if he's going to play this sort of what is called the 3-2-1 strategy in the Rubio campaign, that is, he comes third in Iowa, second in New Hampshire, and then wins South Carolina and sort of starts to emerge as, if not the presumptive front runner, as the alternative to Trump rather than Cruz being. So there's so much at stake here, and you can imagine it's a pretty tense situation. And so inevitably, when it's set up in a conflictual situation like that, you aren't gonna sit on your hands. You're gonna defend yourself, and so it made for a very feisty situation.
And the immigration, there was nothing more visceral than the he said, you did, you didn't do, thing over immigration. Here's a clip. I want to get your feedback on this, okay?
Yeah.
Let me fix this first. there's clearly a couple things going on there, and I think I may. Let me see if I've got it fixed now. Let's see.
If you want to defend the country, it begins with border security, and this is where I've had my disagreement with Senator Rubio. When he brought forward the Gang of Eight bill to give citizenship to those who came here illegally, I put forward an amendment that says we should have more scrutiny on those who are coming as students, those who are coming as immigrants, those who are coming as refugees, because we'd had two refugees come to my town in Bowling Green and try to attack us. Marco opposed this because they made a deal. He made a deal with Chuck Schumer that he would oppose any conservative amendments. And I think that's a mistake, and I just don't think Marco can have it both ways. You can't be in favor of defending us against Islam, radical Islam, if you're not for border security.
Might I respond? The first thing, I don't know of anyone who's not in favor of fully vetting people that are trying to come to this country other than perhaps Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. I think we all support that. Rand's amendment was not the right way to do it. I do believe that people who are trying to come to the United States, this country has a right to know who they are and why they are coming. And that's why I've been very clear. When I am the President of the United States of America, we don't know who you are, and we don't know why you're trying to come to the United States, you are not going to get in. Because the radical threat that we now face from ISIS is extraordinary and unprecedented. And when I'm president, we are keeping ISIS out of America.
Governor Christie, let's talk about profiling.
So there, I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, this is where there seems to be Cruz and Rubio, because they're in the Senate, you can make them look like they're on all sides of the amnesty issue.
And Paul, of course, as well.
It
is difficult for them. This is a point, of course, that Chris Christie continually gets across, more so interestingly enough than Bush and Kasich do, about the difference between being a governor and having to make decisions rather than debating them. Of course, Christie is, the governors are fortunate enough that not only do they not often have to be sort of on both sides of an issue because there are so many bills that they have to debate in the legislative body, but also on immigration, it's largely a federal issue. And so governors are sort of on the sidelines just making comments rather than making policy. They have the luxury of that. But yeah, you're right. So that's one thing. I think it does demonstrate how difficult it is in the Senate, and specifically on this issue of immigration. I also thought
Rubio attacks Cruz. I mean, so Cruz, you know, Cruz is out there tweeting, no, I'm the guy that's going to get it right on immigration. I've got it right. I've been consistent, but...
And what accentuated it, Chad, as well, was the Fox's using their own words against them thing.
Here's a second clip from that same thing. This is where Rubio goes after Cruz.
Schumer, agrees with Ted Cruz on this.
I understand, but let me respond. That was mentioned on this in this answer, and so I'm going to respond on this way. This is the lie that Ted's campaign is built on, and Rand touched upon it, that he's the most conservative guy, and everyone else is a rhino. The truth is, Ted, throughout this campaign, you've been willing to say or do anything in order to get votes. Ted, you worked for George W. Bush's campaign. You helped design George W. Bush's immigration policy. And then when you got to the Senate, you did an interview with CBS News that wasn't even part of the video, where you said, on the issue of people that are here illegally, we can reach a compromise. And then in the committee, you said, I want to bring people out of the shadows. Now you want to Trump on immigration. But you can't. We're not going to beat Hillary Clinton with someone who's willing to say or do anything to win an election.
Go ahead.
That was pretty brutal.
Yeah. Yeah, it undercuts Cruz a little bit as well, because regardless of positions on issues, and Cruz obviously is saying that he's a sort of true and consistent conservative on issues, regardless of what the position is, it undermines perhaps not the conservative argument that Cruz is making, but the consistent argument. And one of the things that Cruz continues to say is that I'm consistent, what you see is what you get. You know, sometimes you might not like me or my approach or my positions on issues, but at least I'm transparent. And what Rubio is subtly getting at there is not only is Cruz not as conservative on immigration issues as you think he tells you he is, but also he's being deceptive and he is not consistent and he's not transparent. And so I thought that was pretty effective. Of course, Rubio's getting it at the same time from Paul, Cruz, and Bush on immigration. There's a bit later, of course, where Bush comes in and talks about the issue as well. But it is interesting to see that issue as well, how it's changed. You might remember in 2012 that Newt Gingrich made a strategic decision to basically take a position which is probably at the Gang of Eight position, maybe even more to the left of the Gang of Eight position, which is to say, look, you might call it amnesty, whatever, we can't split families up, that people come here, and this is the word that has been used against Bush by Trump, coming here is an act of love. I know Gingrich didn't say that, but Gingrich's position was sort of close to that. And he actually got a little bit of a bump out of that after he'd said that in a debate in the early part stages of 2012. And I think you can attribute Gingrich's demise to a number of other things, perhaps including immigration, but a lot of other things as well. But you know, Rubio, who had the Group of Eight position, doesn't feel like Gingrich did in 2012. He feels he really needs to sort of distance himself away from it because he feels that is a sort of radioactive issue this year and is going to cause him a lot of trouble. And I think that those interactions between all four of them, Cruz, Rubio, Paul, and Bush on immigration, illustrative of that fear that, you know, you could be seen as too soft on immigration, even at the expense of trying to finesse an earlier position from a year or two ago, which of course is what Cruz and Rubio were doing there.
When you look at this, did the fortunes of anyone on that stage change last night?
I don't think, in a material way, Chad. No, I think not in a material way. I mean, it's possible at the margins, and the pundit spin on the debate still got to filter into the mainstream consciousness of the public. But I really can't see it. I mean, did you see?
Yeah. When I see this, I actually think Jeb is less discombobulated. I love that utilization of a phrase that probably isn't true. But he seemed a little more together.
I think Trump throws him off.
Yep. I think he hates Trump. I think he hates him so much that when Trump is on stage, Jeb can hardly speak English.
Yeah, and I think he did. I think he had a pretty good night last night.
Yeah, I think he did have a good night. And I think that Christie had a good night. I think, you know, Christie, the fascinating thing about Christie is he's very good on his feet. There's a charisma factor that I think he misses for a couple of reasons, but he's very good on his feet. He's very good at articulating what the heck a governor does and why being an executive matters. And good at throwing all the sitting senators under a bus on stage at the same time. Kasich continues to muddle on. I don't know how Kasich muddles on. I mean no disrespect to any of them. They're all fine people that I can tell, but man, but Cruz and Rubio, it's just brutal to watch those two. And I would say a year ago, they were friends.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes it's a function of similarity. I think there is some ideological space between them. But they are, you know, they're brand new senators from Sun Belt, fairly conservative states. Of course, Texas is more conservative than Florida. Florida's a bit more purple. But new to the scene, fresh, young, Cuban heritage, smart, both of them razor sharp, know what they're doing. Have a clear idea of where they want to go in life. Sometimes you look in the mirror and that's the person you hate the most, right? And I think that they see each other in each other, and they both know they're grasping for that same goal, and it brings out a heightened level of competitiveness. And we saw it last night.
The undercards, you know, we still have Fiorina in there. We still have, Huckabee's there. I think Huckabee and Santorum went off to Trump's event.
Yeah. It is very interesting. Those guys, if you remember, are the two.
The one
immediate
Iowa.
Yep. Exactly. And they were relegated. I mean, if you saw the bit where Trump introduced them last night, I mean, how the mighty have fallen. It must have been excruciating for both of them to sort of, Trump's like, oh, by the way, here's Governor Huckabee. Get up, Governor Huckabee. Get up. Yeah, here they are. and carried on. I mean, it just must have been incredibly humiliating for both of them to sort of be in that situation last night. But of course, it was TV, because wherever Trump goes, there's some attention, so you might as well try to get some of it.
But interesting also that you, an astute political observer, writer, instructor, professor, a guy who knows a lot, okay, on this front, even you were interested in the Trump fundraiser.
Yeah, I went back and forth a little bit in the commercial breaks on Fox, and even a little bit when I thought I knew what the answer was going to be. Yeah, I did. I went back and forth, Chad, to see what Trump was up to.
It's almost like you don't want to admit stuff like you did. I mean, you did. You fessed up. You fessed up immediately. But a lot of people are like, no, I didn't click. Well, yeah, I did once. I didn't want to click on it. But yeah. And it's weird. He has that draw. It's almost like you can't look away.
I don't know if you heard what Brett Baier said this morning.
No, I have not.
But they so the negotiations are going on between Fox and Trump all the way up to, in fact, even through the beginning of the debate. And the moderators had prepared basically two sets of questions, one of a debate with Trump and one without. And they still believed that there was a distinct possibility that he might, you know, stroll in off the street and say, I'm here, I want to participate. So, you know, that gives you some idea of the way Trump operates, but also sort of what the moderators were going through, thinking, wow, it could be just incredible television. You know, the guy just walking in and saying, I'm here, let's get on with it. So I think some of the reason why I was switching back and forth was because I wanted to see where Trump physically was, because I was...
You want to make sure he wasn't walking onto the stage.
It made a grand entrance. It would have been tremendous television.
I think it was, and I think nothing really moved. And it's going to be fascinating as we're going to get to Iowa. Thank goodness we're finally going to stop talking. It's the only time we ever talk about Iowa, and I mean nothing against folks from Iowa. Fine folks, but it is interesting. The only time we ever hear about anything relevant is the caucus. It's not even a primary. It's a caucus.
Yeah. Yeah, and it won't be, you know, definitive. It won't be determinative of the outcome. It might winnow the field, cut a few people out a little bit. But it will be interesting to see, though, if Trump beats Cruz, I don't know, what does that do for Cruz? It doesn't knock him out.
This is a funny thing. The irony to me about Iowa, and I love irony, and we can find it about everywhere, is that it is a state that relies so heavily on subsidies from the federal government related to corn and ethanol production, that many of those, especially those in the Senate, have to pander in some ways. And they want to avoid that topic like the plague, because if Iowa wasn't first, I'll bet you corn subsidies would be gone.
Yeah, well if that's an interesting question, I've actually done some research, not directly on that, but on the amount of money states get and where they are in the order. What actually matters most, if I can tout my own research a little bit here, what actually matters most isn't the order, but whether you're supportive of the ultimate presidential, the winner of the presidential election. So the argument really is, if you're a state, and you're thinking about getting goodies from the federal government, and you're thinking about using the presidential nomination process as a way of getting goodies, don't necessarily go early. Just make sure you back the winner so he can pay you back when he's in office.
Right.
That actually, and of course, by going first, you actually make it more difficult to pick the winner, because you have a fuller field to choose between. But I know,
and
where
you have a history of not picking winners in Iowa.
Well, they pick corn there. That's what they say in New Hampshire, right? They pick winners in New Hampshire. Yeah. They pick corn. And I think that, you know, who we'll see whether it happens again. By the way, just one little point on this. Cruz, of course, has broken the mold on that. Cruz has basically said that, you know, he shouldn't have the ethanol subsidy. So he, to give him his due, he has tried to take that piece of conventional wisdom on. And he seems to be doing okay even by attacking the subsidy.
Very interesting. But anything else that you think, any surprises you think we're going to see at Iowa?
I think the big issue, the two big issues, Chad, are who wins, Trump or Cruz? And then Rubio needs to come third. I think Rubio really needs to come third. And then, again, I don't think it, Cruz coming second and Rubio coming fourth, say, would end Cruz and Rubio. But I think it would be bad for them, obviously. I think Cruz would obviously would really, a win here would be really good for him. And Rubio needs to sort of beat the other establishment, quotation mark, guys,
right,
by getting third.
And as it winnows down, where do those voters go? And I, you know, I think the conventional wisdom on that is out too. I think there are plenty of those candidates that aren't, that if they get out, that aren't going to necessarily benefit Cruz or Rubio. Could, but I think conventional wisdom saying they're all going to go to one candidate is wrong. I think that there's a lot of different candidates they'll look at, you know, second and third place. But thank you so much, Professor Taylor, for being a part of our broadcast.
You're welcome, Chad. Always love to be here.
Much
Enjoy
more to go.
Thank you very much.
Tim Boyum coming up next, News 14 Carolina. We're going to do our weekly summary. So stay tuned to the second hour here at What Matters with Chad Adams.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. House Speaker Tim Moore said Thursday that he'd like to give teachers raises this year, but called a proposal for a 10% increase unrealistic. The News and Observer reports that's the amount Superintendent of Public Instruction June Atkinson suggested as a base pay increase Wednesday at a House Select Committee meeting. Raising all public school teachers' salaries by 10% would cost the state close to $540 million. Moore told the same committee a 2% raise proposed in the House budget last year was more likely to be considered. Any increase has to be negotiated with the Senate. The U.S. economy's growth slowed sharply in the final 3 months of 2015 to a 0.7% annual rate. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The reasons for the slowdown? Consumers reduced spending, businesses cut back on investment, and global problems trimmed exports. The government's estimate of the economy's expansion in the October-December period was the weakest showing since a severe winter reduced growth to a 0.6% annual rate in last year's first quarter. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Fox News says it was not about to contribute $5 million to Donald Trump's charities in order to get Trump to take part in last night's Republican presidential debate. Fox says although Trump had said he was going to boycott the debate because of his feud with the network, he also said he would have shown up had Fox made the donation. Trump held his own rally last night in Iowa, just a few miles from where the Fox News debate was being held. The Trump campaign says the frontrunner's rally raised $6 million for veterans. Meanwhile, the other Republican presidential candidates targeted Trump anyway at the Fox News Channel debate in Iowa. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush joked about Trump's absence.
I kind of miss Donald Trump. He was a little teddy bear to me. We always had such a loving relationship during these debates and in between and the tweets. I kind of miss him. I wish he was here. Everybody else was in the witness protection program when I went after him on behalf of what the Republican cause should be. Conservative principles, believing in limited government, believing in accountability.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's neck and neck with Trump for the lead in Iowa, when asked about the absence of his GOP rival, answered with his best impersonation of the Don.
Let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Senator Marco Rubio says Donald Trump should not be the focus of the presidential campaign.
It's not about Donald Trump. He's an entertaining guy. He's the greatest show on earth. This campaign is about the greatest country in the world and a president who has systematically destroyed many of the things that made America special.
Retired neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson said he's proud he's not a career politician.
You're not going to hear a lot of polished political speech from me, but you will hear the truth. And I don't think you have to be a politician to tell the truth. In fact, sometimes it's not that way around.
Ohio Governor John Kasich added he believes in finding common ground and not encouraging political divisions.
We cannot fix the things in this country, the Social Security, the border, balancing the budget, getting wages to grow faster, unless we lead as conservatives, but we also invite people in from the other party. We have to come together as a country.
While New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said American voters don't care about inside politics, they want a leader who can get things done.
That's the difference between being a governor and having done that for the last 6 years in New Jersey and being someone who has never had to be responsible responsible for any of those decisions. Barack Obama was never responsible for those decisions. Hillary Clinton has never been responsible for those kind of decisions.
And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul didn't hesitate to remind the public about the conduct of former President Bill Clinton and how that reflects on Democratic contender Hillary Clinton.
She can't be a champion of women's rights at the same time she's got this that is always lurking out there, this type of behavior. So it is difficult.
Of her husband's.
Yeah, but I combine this also with the millions upon millions of dollars they've taken from regimes in the Middle East who treat women like cattle.
Iowa voters kick off the 2016 nominating process Monday, offering the first indications of whether Trump's abrupt decision to skip the debate will have any impact on his standing atop the GOP field. And it was a huge turnout at a Panthers Pride rally at a park in Uptown Charlotte today. Players, Sir Purr, the Top Cats, the percussion drumline, and the Black and Blue crew were all on hand for the pre-Super Bowl send-off event. The Panthers gave out more than 2,500 pom-poms and other team souvenirs to fans. The team leaves for California Sunday. They take on the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50, February 7th at 6:30 in Santa Clara. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with Chad Adams.
Second hour underway here. Beautiful Friday. Glad to have you with us. And those listening via podcast, thank you for making us part of your day. So with that being said, our good buddy Tim Boyum, News 14 Carolina, anchorman extraordinaire. Dun, dun, dun. We need to have your own intro music. How are you, Tim?
I'd love some intro music. I'm great. Thank you.
We have you via Skype today because Tim's in all those important meetings where the pretty people that are on TV meet, and then they talk about things they're going to do on TV. So he's with us via Skype today, not in studio, but we're glad to have you nonetheless. All right. Now, first things first, I got to ask you that Supreme Court decision with McCrory and the legislature. What's your take on this? I mean, it came across the wire, clearly going to be a part of your newscast tonight. What's your take? What are you thinking?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's ho-hum in a lot of ways for the average person out there. I think it'll be interesting to see as we head into session. I mean, we heard from Senator Berger and Speaker Moore that they weren't pleased, but they'll move forward. And the governor says he looks forward to working with them. I don't know if this is going to unravel into one of those situations like it has in the past or not. I think it's a wait and see and how it moves forward. We saw Floyd McKissick just tweet out a while ago. He seemed pleased with the decision. So I don't know. I think it's a wait and see.
Because I think there are many implications that could play out if it comes to it, there could be a lot of review of other boards and commissions that they could realign some of these things.
Well, I mean, everything's a power play, right? And so now they know where the court stands and where they can play on that line and where they can shift that line. So, yeah, I don't think there's any question people are going to test those lines and where they can go. The question is how fast they decide to do that moving forward. Based on the ruling today, but we finally got to the highest court in the state, so at least we know where that line is.
Now I'm going to ask you this: we just spent a good bit of time talking about it. Did you watch any of the mixed martial arts thing? No, it was a debate. Okay,
I did. I watched the entire debate. Believe it or not, I didn't watch a second of the Trump event. That's not a knock against Trump. But I was more interested in seeing how the other candidates handled themselves than I was what I knew to probably expect at Trump. So I actually watched the whole thing.
What'd you think? Just initial reaction.
I think for your average person, it was probably pretty dull, except for the exchanges.
For the attacks on one another when they were trying to pummel each other in the ground with words.
Right. I mean, the first 30 minutes were a little dull, I think, which I'd probably turn off a lot of people. But yeah, when the middle chunk was probably the best part. I thought it was fascinating. I mean, I'll get out my tinfoil, right? Like, so
you're,
I thought
wait,
it was
wait, wait.
Fascinating.
Now, you just said you put on your tinfoil hat. For many people that aren't familiar with that phrase, it basically, Tim Boyum was just saying, I'm going to put on my cuckoo hat right now and my paranoia, government watching me, X-Files, drones are listening to my conversation hat, and go.
That's right. So you saw the exchange where they put the video out of Cruz and Rubio where they were basically flip-flopping back and forth. I thought it was questionable. I thought it was very interesting, yes. I thought it was questionable how they targeted two particular persons on that stage to that not. But imagine if Donald Trump was on that stage and that video came out with him with all of those various comments he's made over the last 30 to 40 years. I mean, is it possible he got wind they were doing that and that's why he backed out? I mean, I think a video like that would have been devastating for him last night. And so I think he was the big winner because he was not there just for that fact alone.
I think he's because he's an 800-pound gorilla that's not in the room. And so he wins by – he gets mentioned, talked about. He's clearly some guy that's relevant, and he's not even there. So
yeah, I thought – I was astonished that Ted Cruz went after the moderators and the format of the debate. I mean, there's proven history that is the worst possible thing to do is to whine about questions and timing at a debate. I didn't think it went great for him last night. I thought he had a great opportunity. I thought Rubio and Christie were pretty strong. I guess Bush was better. I mean, it seemed to be everybody thought he was way better. I just think it's so too little too late for him. I don't even think it matters what he does on that stage.
And final comment from me on what you just said was a very astute observation. I wish I had mentioned it earlier. It has been said on Facebook by a lot of folks I respect, one of them being John Hamm, Mary Catherine Hamm's father, also the editor of Carolina Journal. And he said what you said. Everybody, and especially someone with Cruz's background and experience, should know better than to go after the moderators. It's just that's a very tactical, amateurish mistake. And I was surprised. I'm very impressed you picked up on that, though. Good observation. Now,
yay! 1 point for Tim.
Special award for Tim. Now, I've got to ask you another story that's out there that's kind of breaking, I guess, this afternoon. It's flying through the Twitter sphere about 2 o'clock this afternoon, and that is that a federal watchdog has found the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services roughly misspent $500,000 in federal grant money intended to pay for prevention in public health programs. This is yet another knock on the – I mean, this is it's just been a rough couple years for HHS in North Carolina, hasn't it?
That's to say the least. And supposedly they might be under – you're talking about the state – I lost you there for a little bit. You're talking about the state HHS, right?
Yes. I mean, they looked at $500,000 that they misspent. You know, the study looked at expenditures made from 2010 to 2013. Part of that's under, you know, Aldona Walsh's watch. This is – yet, you know, we know there are other problems there that have been looked at. This isn't good.
You have to ask yourself – look, there's like, what, 18,000 employees at HHS. You have to ask yourself whether some of this is coming because the organization is just too large. And look, they're supposedly under a federal investigation right now as
right.
well.
In addition to, yeah.
And we've been trying to work with them on a number of stories ourselves, and it has been a challenge to work with the folks in general. I don't mean that from they're not good people to work with, but, you know, there's just – I just wonder if that organization has gotten too big and there's too much going on and there's not enough oversight over individual things going on over there. But yeah, I mean, it's they've been in the headlines. I mean, obviously when Vosh was there and we were all trying to get interviews and there's issues with NC Tracks, and the problem is this stuff's so complicated too that it's hard to explain to people. Like, I mean, it's just, it seems like it is one thing after another.
It is kind of bizarre. Now, looking, you know, the situation we talked about with McCrory and the legislature stuff, any other things that you've seen out there this week that kind of pique your interest? Because that means a lot of things that are happening, you know, there are primaries that are out there, this situation. We have discussed on TV and off the situation with the I-77 toll road stuff. It looks like that issue is just not going to simmer down anytime soon. Are you kind of – I will tell you, I'm kind of surprised at not just the persistence – but the spread. I mean, more and more people, even in Wilmington, I was there yesterday and people were talking about it.
People who hate tolls are some of the loudest people you will meet. And I don't mean volume necessarily, but they are passionate about what they do. They have a great ability at a grassroots level to organize, and they have a great effect on the people because they're very good at messaging. I'll just put it that way. I totally agree. And before you even brought up 77, you asked me what else was percolating. I was going to say 77. You know, we had Robert Brawley on, who's running against Governor McCrory on Monday. He claims that he talked to Tony Tate in the administration that they said this was just the beginning and that other roads across the state were going to have these additional managed lanes added. A lot of people don't realize is you can't add tolls on existing roads. So what they're doing is they're adding lanes to existing roads to create these tolls. Robert Brawley said that he's been told it's just the beginning. Today, we had Tricia Cotham on, who's a Democrat from Mecklenburg County. as well as Dan Bishop, who's also Republican from Mecklenburg County. Trisha Coffin made it sound like that there may be some legislation filed as soon as session starts to try to cut this deal with Cintra, who's the company that they cut this deal with to manage the lanes. And, you know, Dan Bishop was sort of saying this isn't Corey's blame. We can't put it on him. This is a local decision. So I think where you fall on this issue, it's going to have a huge impact. And I it'll be interesting. The Democrats have come out twice this week from a state party level and attacked McCrory on the issue of toll roads. So it's definitely not going anywhere. And I'm sure it'll be an issue question about whether it's about trust or about toll roads at the end of the day. But the broader issue is definitely making its impact.
And I don't think it's going to change the outcome of the primary. Okay, let me preface that. My cogitating on this and looking at this, I don't see this being it is a big issue. I do think, however, that as we move to the fall, that already we see the sniping between Attorney General Roy Cooper and McCrory. Cooper's trying to, McCrory's people are saying, hey, Cooper's involved in this, and Cooper's people saying, hey, if we were governor, there wouldn't be a toll road.
Yeah, and I'm not convinced it will be a major issue in the fall election either yet. I mean, I'm just not 100% convinced of that. I'm not saying it couldn't be, but I'm also not convinced that there's going to be something that occurs at the legislature that might take it out of the governor's hands. Whether that's some bill that, you know, forces a cancellation and he can say the legislature decided they're going to do it, I don't know. I don't think this decision by the regional board to continue on with the toll lanes and the governor saying yes is the end of the story yet. And I think April 25th is going to be a huge indication of what happens. Now, whether the legislators that are against this have support, I don't know either, but I can guarantee you it's going to be a good trading point for those that don't care.
No doubt. And so as we're looking across the state, many issues are percolating out there. This teacher raise, I know that there's two things related to teachers I want to talk to you about. The first being that, hey, June Atkinson running for reelection, it's time to promise the world. And so she's saying 10% raises for all teachers. We've just got tons of money. Well, it kind of went over to the House, and Tim Moore, you know, not someone who's really outspoken on things, said, whoa, wait a minute. Speaker of the House says, I think we may have 2%. This is a kind of a number we're looking at, but, you know, the state Senate has to approve anything that happens. It looks like everybody's like wanting to give them raises, but scared they're going to get accused of not giving a lot, but no discussion about curriculum or what they deserve to get.
You'd almost think it was an election year, wouldn't you?
You would almost think that, you know, weirdest thing. I was thinking the same thing.
I asked June Atkinson was on the program last night, and I said to her, is this realistic and how do you pay for it? And she actually said, it's an election year. They can find a way. I mean, I'm simplifying what she said, but
man, you know what? You can give her an easy answer. What you ought to do next time is give her an easy puffball answer, you know, question like you just teed up for, and then say, but June, I want you to answer it in a Common Core way, which will take you 5 minutes to answer a 30-second question.
I ain't touching that one. That's
come on. That would be so much fun. It would be, you know, ratings would go through the roof. People would write in being, wow, you just made June Atkinson answer a question in a Common Core way of looking at the world.
I only have 30 minutes. There's your little joke I'll give towards that one.
I just thought you would like that, Tim.
I'll give you something on Common Core in a minute, too, based on a conversation I had with her. But I'll answer your other question first. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch this teacher raise debate, because if they can't do 2% again, I don't think that's enough. I don't see them doing that. What I do think is interesting is revenues are ahead. And so do they do some sort of small random increase or differentiation pay or give math and science more? And then do they do a one-time larger percentage bonus or something that looks like a big raise, but it's 1 year? And the reason I say that is in order for due to June's plan, that's what's called recurring, meaning you got to come up with that $540 million year after year after year. If they found extra revenue this year to give in a big raise, they could give a 7% raise, but it's only for 1 year and doesn't affect the budget long term. That's something I'm going to be watching closely as session starts in April.
Because one time is so much. You know, they did that with state employees a while back. They gave them an extra week of vacation, $1,000 one time, you know, kind of thing, because there's no recurring things when you do a one-time bonus. So it will be interesting to watch. Now, you were going to say something about Common Core, but
yeah. So I was fascinated about the reaction of they basically just made the math. They didn't change the math, which was basically the whole reason why people really wanted to change Common Core. And so the question I think becomes, is Senator Jerry Tillman does he help push forward a bill that somehow changes Common Core math or requires them to go back and look at it again? And I've been told by a number of people that they feel like he's been sort of put into a box with this, because if they just adopted, say, the Minnesota standards, which are what a lot of people consider to be better math standards that don't like Common Core, they're picking standards that aren't North Carolina standards, which is what the whole argument was about, not picking up national standards or other people's and making our own standards. And so I think that's going to be another fascinating thing to watch as we move forward here. I mean, I think that was one of the largest untold stories in politics in some time, was that they went through this whole rigmarole about Common Core and getting rid of this math standards, and they end up changing the English and literature a little bit and don't touch the math. I mean, that was just fascinating.
But and yet the recommendations are to get rid of the math. This is very controversial, and I'm just kind of surprised they're sticking around with the math. I mean, are you surprised that this is still a persistent problem in North Carolina with all of the controversy?
In some ways, I am. However, that board that was put together was not as experienced in a lot of these disciplines. That they did not hire a lot of outside experts to help that understand curriculum. And so in some ways, you know, remember how slow of a start they got off to? They didn't have money for months and months and months, which wasn't necessarily their fault, but they were so slow moving forward. And so the way that this all came together, I guess looking back in some ways, I'm not surprised. But those folks that don't like Common Core, I mean, they have got to be furious right now that they went through all of this and that this is the end result.
So, but remains to be seen. I still think that's going to be a controversial issue. I think the Republicans are going to find themselves, if they're not careful, on issues like Common Core. Republicans are in complete control of government. Republicans across the board can't stand, despise, detest Common Core. They find themselves with a number of issues that with their base is starting to become, it was a low drumbeat. It's becoming louder, more persistent. Common Core, renewable energy portfolio, the renewable energy stuff, solar stuff, certificate of need stuff. It's growing. And do you think it'll ever become problematic?
I mean, it could. The one thing and the advantage for the folks that are potentially facing these problems is we're only about, 45 days away from a primary election. And after that, I guess they have to worry about people not voting in the race in the fall. But look, it's a major presidential election year. Those people are going to go vote. And that's why I'm still a little skeptical about I-77 having a huge impact on Governor McCrory. I mean, those people are going to have to consciously skip over the governor's race. And I'm just not so certain they'll do that at the end of the day. And because of that, I'm not so certain it's going to be a huge issue with the legislature. Now, is it going to be an internal caucus problem as we head through this year and then eventually picking a speaker in November? No question about it. It's going to be a huge issue. But I'm not so sure about the public pressure and the impact that might have on it.
You said something about the speaker. Do you think there could be again, I have a certain perspective because I'm on the conservative side of things. You have to be more middle of the road. You think there's an issue with this, with Speaker's office?
Well, I'm just saying I wouldn't be shocked if there's some sort of attempt to put up another candidate next November. Don't forget they're going to vote on a House Speaker again in November for the 2017-2018 biennium. And so, I frankly, with how much is going on with dissension, I'd be shocked if there wasn't another candidate. Now, I don't know if it's going to be someone that has a legitimate shot of beating Speaker Moore. But I do think a lot of what happens this session with some of those issues that you described definitely will play a role about whether there's a someone that is a legitimate threat to the speaker and a re-election from that standpoint. Not an election with the general public, but within his own caucus.
Let's turn attention to some money issues. And this is funny because some of it's spin, but some of it I think that there's some serious – it's going to become problematic for the McCrory folks, or it's going to be an incentive for the Cooper folks. Roy Cooper, Attorney General, running for governor. McCrory running for his second term. His team, the people who are raising money for each of these respective candidates, Cooper's had some good numbers out there. And for two quarters in a row, he's outraised a sitting incumbent Republican governor. I've heard many discussions about this. Some of them have to do with, hey, the people raising money. Maybe one team's better than the other. The other is that there's an enthusiasm problem. I don't know why that would be a problem. The governor's got a lot he can grow about. What's your take on this fundraising thing? Because then McCrory's people said, oh, well, that's because Attorney General Roy Cooper's out there running for office and not doing his job, which I thought was more of a spin answer. But your thoughts?
Well, I thought that was a strange answer. Isn't that what Governor McCrory's doing, too?
Yeah, they're both raising money. Yeah.
And they're both in elected office, right?
Yeah, that's an affirmative there.
Okay, just checking. I thought that was kind of funny and odd too. Here's the deal. I don't think the money itself is a major issue. $800,000 is kind of a lot of money, obviously. But in the scheme of $5 million, it's not insane. And outside money is going to play such a dominant role that I don't think that alone will be means that Roy Cooper can win this race. I question whether the enthusiasm factor is part of it. You know, we've been talking for the past 3.5 years, well, a little over 3 years, about the schism within the party and whether McCrory has brought all of them back in and what some of them feel. And Democrats are motivated to get Pat McCrory out of office. And so I do think there is a potentially motivation factor. And I've also heard stories about Governor McCrory's just doesn't really get into these fundraisers. And that's not a knock on him as being Republican, because Governor Easley was not a big fan of these things as well. But that could be playing a role in too. And maybe that's just enough to where Cooper is working a little bit harder and raising that $800,000. But if I'm in his camp, I have to be concerned, because this is nowhere near normal. It's very unusual for I don't care how experienced Roy Cooper is. He still has no name recognition and is out raising incumbent governor by $800,000.
True. But when you look on down ballot, you get to the Richard Burr Senate race and Deborah Ross. You know, clearly the Democrats are having more problems raising money there than they are for the governor's race. And then you look at the attorney general's race for Democrats here, Josh Dine, you know, almost 40% as much money as the sitting incumbent Republican governor. I mean, $1.5 million. These are impressive numbers that Stein's putting up. I know he's connected nationally, self-help, and all those other left-leaning groups, but wow, that's a pretty impressive amount of money to put up.
Well, some of his team is some of the same team that is being used by Cooper. So in some ways, it's not surprising. They've been incredibly focused for a long time. Look, they've been running as long as the others have been running. Cooper's been running for, you know, most people say for a couple of years. Stein has sort of been running for this for, you know, ever since Cooper thought about running. Deborah Ross is in a different position. You know, she just decided late last fall. Some argue that $500,000 in just a couple months shows quite a bit on her part. And I think that's why the DSCC ended up endorsing her. I also think that endorsement shows that they think she needs it in order to raise more money. But I mean, Burr has something like $5.3 million and she has $500,000. So it's going to take more than a little bit of help. Her benefit is if she wins March 15th and avoids a runoff, there is a very long general election in North Carolina this year, and that could help her. But I mean, money is going to be a huge problem for Democrats in that race.
Now, let's ask you some questions about the race. You're in the news beast. And again, we're very wonkish here. Clearly, our audience is very politically astute. It's leaders, it's decision makers, it's activists.
Are you saying your audience is smarter than mine?
I am.
Okay.
How's that?
Checking.
Okay. Just making sure you understand that. Okay. Making
Thank you.
Sure you elevate your intellect when you come on this show. We appreciate you doing that. You know, we don't deal with Common Core answers. You know, we deal with direct answers. I know your audience, you know, Common Core and stuff like that. They're pretty people. They're used to looking at pretty people. Ours, you know, I have a face made for radio, so it's different.
Well, I must not have any ratings if they're looking for pretty people.
But do you think the public, because I believe we've entered a time of fatigue. I think, gosh, now it seems like the election has been going on forever, and we're not even to the primary yet.
I don't think anybody cares about anything but the presidential race, period. I think people think that sideshow is fascinating on the Republican side. And I had this discussion with a few people this week, because I'm not even getting phone calls from Republican lieutenant governor candidates begging to be on the program. And I find that shocking. And it's not just me. Other people, there's not a lot. I mean, you're not seeing any ads on television at all. At my house, I mean, I'm a registered independent. I don't have any mailers that have come to my house for the election yet at all. And I know people are saying it's early still, but come on, Monday's February. And so I think everybody's just hoping to get through this primary and survive or beat somebody. And the presidential contest has taken the air out of everything. And yeah, people have gotten a little tired of it. But the good news with that is Monday we finally start having votes coming in, and people are going to start getting out of the race that should have probably never been in the race in the first place. And so I think it's a temporary lull, but I'm fascinated. I would love to be in on the strategy session with some of these down ballot candidates to figure out what they're doing and how they think they're going to win without doing anything.
Well, we will see. I just, you know, it seems like the election process has become infinite. It never stops. We finish up with 2014 in November of last year. There's a little lull where, you know, hey, Tom Tillis gets sworn in and there's a bunch of city council races all over the state. And then boom, we're in the presidential race in June. Trump, I mean, everyone's running for president. It's like the infinite campaign. Now, and as soon as the primaries are over, hopefully in March, then we've got that marathon to the general election, which just seems like, and I don't know how much people are going to forget through the summer, but man, it just seems.
But you think they're fatigued now? We have a general election that starts March 16th and runs until November 4th. I don't think we've ever had a general election season that went that long. And I think there's going to be a huge period of dead time in the middle of the summer where, yes, the presidential race is going to go on, but I love the strategy that goes into this stuff. And I would just I would give anything to be in on the strategy sessions for both of these candidates on both sides to figure out how they're going to, you know, handle this in the next 6 to 9 months. Cause this is amazing to me. And the whole Trump factor has helped elevate the level of attention in this race, which is, I think, where that fatigue comes from. I think if he wasn't in the race, I think it would have been a little quieter. But yeah, I mean, starting debates in August and whatnot is definitely tiring people out.
Absolutely. And it's, hey, there's a circus element to some of this. Tim, thank you for being a part of our broadcast as always. And, you know, enjoy those staff meetings. We're going to get you back in the studio soon. All right.
I promise. Thank you.
Tim Boyd of News 14 Carolina. Much more to go here on What Matters with Chad Adams. Stay tuned.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. House Speaker Tim Moore said Thursday that he'd like to give teachers raises this year, but called a proposal for a 10% increase unrealistic. The News and Observer reports that's the amount Superintendent of Public Instruction June Atkinson suggested as a base pay increase Wednesday at a House Select Committee meeting. Raising all public school teachers' salaries by 10% would cost the state close to $540 million. Moore told the same committee a 2% raise proposed in the House budget last year was more likely to be considered. Any increase has to be negotiated with the Senate. The U.S. economy's growth slowed sharply in the final 3 months of 2015 to a 0.7% annual rate. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
The reasons for the slowdown? Consumers reduced spending, businesses cut back on investment, and global problems trimmed exports. The government's estimate of the economy's expansion in the October-December period was the weakest showing since a severe winter reduced growth to a 0.6% annual rate in last year's first quarter. Shelley Adler, Washington.
Fox News says it was not about to contribute $5 million to Donald Trump's charities in order to get Trump to take part in last night's Republican presidential debate. Fox says although Trump had said he was going to boycott the debate because of his feud with the network, he also said he would have shown up had Fox made the donation. Trump held his own rally last night in Iowa, just a few miles from where the Fox News debate was being held. The Trump campaign says the frontrunner's rally raised $6 million for veterans. Meanwhile, the other Republican presidential candidates targeted Trump anyway at the Fox News Channel debate in Iowa. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush joked about Trump's absence.
I kind of miss Donald Trump. He was a little teddy bear to me. We always had such a loving relationship during these debates and in between and the tweets. I kind of miss him. I wish he was here. Everybody else was in the witness protection program when I went after him on behalf of what the Republican cause should be. Conservative principles, believing in limited government, believing in accountability.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's neck and neck with Trump for the lead in Iowa, when asked about the absence of his GOP rival, answered with his best impersonation of the Don.
Let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Senator Marco Rubio says Donald Trump should not be the focus of the presidential campaign.
It's not about Donald Trump. He's an entertaining guy. He's the greatest show on earth. This campaign is about the greatest country in the world and a president who has systematically destroyed many of the things that made America special.
Retired neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson said he's proud he's not a career politician.
You're not going to hear a lot of polished political speech from me, but you will hear the truth. And I don't think you have to be a politician to tell the truth. In fact, sometimes sometimes it's not that way around.
Ohio Governor John Kasich added he believes in finding common ground and not encouraging political divisions.
We cannot fix this things in this country, the Social Security, the border, balancing the budget, getting wages to grow faster, unless we lead as conservatives, but we also invite people in from the other party. We have to come together as a country.
While New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said American voters don't care about inside politics, they want a leader who can get things done.
That's the difference between being a governor and having done that for the last 6 years in New Jersey and being someone who has never had to be responsible for any of those decisions. Barack Obama was never responsible for those decisions. Hillary Clinton has never been responsible for those kind of decisions.
And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul didn't hesitate to remind the public about the conduct of former President Bill Clinton and how that reflects on Democratic contender Hillary Clinton.
She can't be a champion of women's rights at the same time she's got this that is always lurking out there, this type of behavior. So it is difficult.
Of her husband's.
Yeah, but I combine this also with the millions upon millions of dollars they've taken from regimes in the Middle East who treat women like cattle.
Iowa voters kick off the 2016 nominating process Monday, offering the first indications of whether Trump's abrupt decision to skip the debate will have any impact on his standing atop the GOP field. And it was a huge turnout at a Panthers Pride rally at a park in Uptown Charlotte today. Players, Sir Purr, the Top Cats, the percussion drumline, and the Black and Blue crew were all on hand for the pre-Super Bowl send-off event. The Panthers gave out more than 2,500 pom-poms and other team souvenirs to fans. The team leaves for California Sunday. They take on the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl 50, February 7th, at 6:30 in Santa Clara. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with Chad Adams.
Oh, it is a fascinating time. It really is. This thing with Health and Human Services, it's like one step forward, two steps back. Every time things seem to kind of get it together, there's yet another thing. We know that the folks in there trying to do, they've got a huge federal mandate. They're dealing with a lot of money. They're dealing with 100 counties. They're dealing with so many complexities, 18,000 employees. Tim Boyum mentioned, it is just a massive agency with tons of problems, systemic leadership. It's difficult to grapple with. The legislature even has trouble grappling with it. And if anything, it is illustrative of the fact that government has gotten too big. That's just the state version of this agency. I mean, if anything, no one has a handle on anything over there. And it's not necessarily their fault. It's just, my prediction is we're going to see more and more of these kind of stories where there's just, it's waste, fraud, abuse, oversight or lacking oversight, inefficiencies, nothing new in government spending. It's just sad because it's going to become more prolific because it's just nearly impossible to track all that stuff. So it's just very, 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 very sad situation. So here's hoping they can get through it. But who knows? Now, in other news, the news that we kind of started the day with was this AP news story breaking that the Obama administration confirmed for the first time Friday that Hillary Clinton's unsecured home server contained closely guarded government secrets. Now, not only is she complicit in setting this up. Clearly, it had to be set up. She was able to receive these things. But the folks in government that are in that administration should have said, we can't do this. The secretary, we can't send these messages to her in this way. So there's so many aspects of this. They censored 22 emails with material requiring one of the highest levels of classification to an unsecured server. We, the American public, in fact, as we said earlier, we could probably get those emails from other countries easier than we can get them from our own government because they probably have all of them. And the fact that people still support her is astounding. It is astounding that they will look the other way. I think she could firebomb an orphanage and walk out and say, I didn't do it. And her supporters would say, clearly the press is out to get her. Clearly those right-wingers are out to get her. This has nothing. This is the administration, the Democrat administration that she worked in is saying these things happened. And again, I'm sure Hannity and Rush and all the other national shows are talking ad nauseum about this stuff. But it is astounding. Had this happened 60 years ago, she would be, well, you know, not email, but if the point being, if she had done this 60 years ago, it would be an act of treason. She could face a firing squad for stuff like this. Disclosing state secrets to foreign governments, that's treasonous. She doesn't care. It's just astounding that her supporters don't care. Ugh. You know, this is, and you've heard me say it on the show before, and don't twist my words because there are some of you out there that would like to do that. When you look at some of these candidates, you know, one thing about Bernie Sanders, I don't believe he's unethical. I don't believe he's a liar. I believe he's actually a very decent guy as an individual. I disagree with him profoundly. But as far as a guy who's telling you, hey, I'm a socialist, if you elect me, here's what I'm going to do. He's honest about what he wants to do. He's not consulting polls. He's not out there saying, hey, what do I need to say to get more attention? He's telling you how he feels. Wouldn't it be neat if all of the candidates were that honest? One thing about Donald Trump, love him or hate him, that's what you're getting on the Republican side. And even a couple of the other, I think that Rand Paul is completely telling you how he feels about things. I think Christie, for the most part, yes. I think a lot of them are. I think that Cruz and Rubio, because they sit in the Senate where many things are nuanced, and they really are, and that is a problem. When you're trying to go from a body like the Senate into an executive branch, it's very hard to say, my record is very clear, because it's not. It's not. When you're voting for bills that have tons, it's like these folks over the House of North Carolina. You know, they say, you know, they vote for one thing and then they pass a piece of legislation in the middle of the night, things like that. I mean, ugh. Ugh. Now, we'll turn our attention over. I'm going to go through this piece, and I am a big fan of Charles Krauthammer. He has a great piece. I had alluded to this in the first part of the show. He has been to North Carolina several times and given speeches to various groups. A very bright, I mean, just extremely, a great deal of mental acuity, powers of observation, looking at what's more than just a talking head. I don't think he's out there for himself. He's just very good at observing stuff. And he has a fantastic piece over at the New York Daily News. And I'm going to try to go through it. I don't like to read a lot of columns. I do go through columns, but I think this is, I think it's very good to point out kind of where we are. It's kind of a snapshot of where we are looking back and looking forward. And here's what he had to say. It's hard to believe that the United States, having resisted the siren song of socialism during its entire 20th century heyday, the only major democracy on the planet to do so, should suddenly succumb to its charms a generation after its intellectual demise. That's a great piece of language. Basically, after we've beaten socialism across the planet, we retained our republic in many ways. We didn't succumb to it force of at the end of a war. We're succumbing to it because it sounds charming. He goes on to say, indeed, the prospect of socialist Bernie Sanders, whatever his current momentum, winning the Democrat nomination remains far-fetched. The Dems would be risking a November electoral disaster of historic dimensions, yet there is no denying how far Sanders has pulled his party to the left. Yes. And how hard the establishment candidate, yes, the Democrats have establishment too, the establishment candidate, Hillary Clinton, has been racing to catch up. In other words, with Bernie in that race, Hillary is moving to the left as hard as she can. Not that she had to go very far, but she's having to be more honest about the fact that she is a devout socialist. The Republicans, back to the column, on the other hand, are dealing with a full-scale riot. The temptation they face is trading in a century of conservatism for Trumpism. The 2016 presidential race has turned into an epic contest between the ethno-nationalist populism of Donald Trump, what a great phrase, and traditional conservatism, though in two varieties. This is very astute. The scorched earth fundamentalist version of Ted Cruz, and a reformist version represented by Marco Rubio and several so-called establishment candidates, and articulated most fully by non-candidate Paul Ryan and a cluster of productive thinkers and wonks dubbed reformicons. Trump insists that he's a conservative, but in his pronouncements and policies, conservatism seems more of a rental, a three-day penthouse rental with Central Park view, to be sure, than an ideological home. Trump protests that Ronald Reagan, too, migrated from left to right. True, but Reagan did it in his 40s, not as with Trump in his 60s, in radically different ways. In radically different ways, Trump and Sanders are addressing the deep anxiety stemming from the secular... Oh, this is just a great line. In radically different ways, Trump and Sanders are addressing the deep anxiety stemming from the secular stagnation in wages and living standards that has squeezed the middle and working class for a generation. Sanders locates the villainy in a billionaire class that has rigged both the economic and political system. In other words, Sanders is saying the bad guys are those rich folks. The bad guys are the rich, and if I'm elected, he's going to stop them. He's going to tax them to death. Back to the column, Trump blames foreigners. Mostly those cunning Mexicans, Chinese, Japanese, and Saudis who've been taking merciless advantage of us in concert with America's own leaders who are alternatively stupid and incompetent or bought and corrupt. Hence Trump's most famous policy recommendations, anti-immigrant, including the forced deportation of 11 million people, anti-trade with a 45% tariff on Chinese goods and a 35% tariff on U.S. manufacturing, moved to Mexico. And anti-Muslim, most notoriously a complete ban on entry into the U.S. temporarily only, we are assured, except that the ban applies until our country's representatives can figure out what's going on, end quote. A standard so indeterminate as to be meaningless. Trump has limited concern for the central tenet of American conservatism, and most especially of the Tea Party movement, limited government. The most telling example is his wholehearted support for eminent domain, i.e. the forcible appropriation by government of private property. Trump called it wonderful. And again, in North Carolina right now, this is a very germane issue. So, yes, if Trump ever gets linked to eminent domain in North Carolina, it would definitely tilt things. And by the way, thank you. A special shout out to the gentleman that Mr. Lassiter, Trent Lassiter, who actually commented and, hey, good victory there. Great work, and he thanked us for our work and his appearance on the show. So thank you for that. Back to the column. Trump has not yet called Vladimir Putin wonderful, but he has taken a shine to the swaggering mini-czar who seems to run his trains on time. When informed that Putin kills opponents and journalists, Trump's initial reaction was, I think that our country does plenty of killing also. The kind of moronic, what about the Crusades moral equivalence that conservatives have railed against for decades. Although, to be fair, after some prompting, Trump did come out against the killing of journalists. Cruz is often lumped with Trump in the anti-establishment camp. That suited Cruz tactically for a while, but it's fairly meaningless, given that establishment can mean anything these days. We talk about that on the show. And given the huge gulf between the political philosophies of the two men, Cruz is a genuine conservative, austere, indeed radical, so much so that he considers mainstream congressional conservatives apostates, and finds Trump not conservative at all, as he is now furiously, belatedly insisting. And this is what Krauthammer says. His personal preference is for the third ideological alternative, the reform conservatism that locates the source of our problems not in billionaires and their heartlessness or crafty foreigners, but in our superannuated, increasingly sclerotic 20th century welfare state structures. Their desperate need for reform has been overshadowed by the new populism, but will make its appearance this year in Congress in Speaker Ryan's agenda. Boring stuff like welfare reform, healthcare reform, tax reform, and institutional congressional reform, such as the return to the regular order. Paired with a president like Rubio or Chris Christie or Carly Fiorina to go a long shot, such an agenda would give conservatism its best opportunity since Reagan to become the country's governing philosophy. Unless the GOP takes the populist leap, in which case a conservative restoration will be a long time coming. I thought that just very astute. I enjoy his writing. I don't always agree with what he says. Here's the thing to me about this race. People have been saying, Chad, you really secretly just admit it. You love Trump. No. What I do think Trump is illustrative of the failure of our public education system in many ways. I think that Bernie, you know, the fact that young people aren't afraid of socialism is a failure of our public education system. I think that people not reading into what all this is. The other thing that Trump represents is a guy who is not beholden to any special interest, who is a revolution, a walking revolution reality, giant ego candidate. He doesn't say things to gain votes. He says things because that's, I believe, what he actually thinks when he's out there walking and talking and being, well, Donald Trump. And so when you look at everyone else trying to out-conservative each other, Trump isn't concerned about that. He's got an R next to his name. He's so important that Rince Priebus and the National Republicans beat a path to his door like, you know, hey, can I? Yeah, it was very Dickensian when Rince Priebus and the rest of the RNC kind of went up to Trump and said, can I have another? Please sign this so you won't run against our candidates if you lose. It's very interesting. They're very Trump makes a mockery of the entire RNC structure. The Republican Party as a whole has been made a mockery of by Trump. But there's no doubting his blue-collar appeal, which no Republicans really been able to capture. The Republicans have long distanced themselves from understanding the appeal at the grassroots level. The closest thing they found to that was in the Tea Party movement of the Obama, you know, the Obamacare fiasco. That was really what galvanized a lot of conservatives and, anti, you know, limited government, low tax group. The taxed enough already Tea Party movement was a phenomenon. And the reverberations, the feelings, the passion is still out there. It's just they've been disappointed by so many Republicans promising so many things that a guy that actually says stuff that they believe him. The next candidate that walks in the room and says, I'm going to deal with the national debt. Nobody believes him. They're the same old ilk. You know, and it's probably the result of our instantly televised society where we have records of all of these congressional Republicans for the past 20 years saying we're going to deal with this. We're going to deal with Social Security reform. We're going to deal with Medicaid, Medicare. We're going to deal with all this entitlement stuff. We're going to reduce the national debt and deficits. And they haven't. They haven't done a thing about it except increase it. And then come back home and say, well, we'll eventually do something about it. So they just don't believe when a traditional candidate stands up anymore. And that's really kind of sad. So... Now, in the stuff you can't believe, well, actually, we're going to take a quick break right now, and we definitely want folks to know about the Conservative Leadership Conference coming up. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and what would you say if a public high school has been accused of Islamic indoctrination here in this country? Well, we're going to tell you a little bit about that on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
Attention, conservatives. Don't miss your chance to hear from former Congressman Colonel Alan West, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, Anne McElhaney, and Dinesh D'Souza March 4th and 5th. The Civitas Institute invites you to the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference in Raleigh. Get your tickets online at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. Join the Civitas Institute and hundreds of fellow conservatives to hear from inspiring leaders and dynamic speakers from the Heritage Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, the Civitas Institute, and many more. Go to CivitasCLC.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. It's time to stand up for the principles that made our country great. Learn how at the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference, March 4th and 5th at the Embassy Suites by Hilton Raleigh-Durham Research Triangle in Cary. Register at CivitasCLC.com or call 919-834-2099. That's 919-834-2099.
You know, sometimes there are stories that are just... You read them and you go, nah, somebody's pulling my leg. So there's no way this is true. You know, even though you pulled it, it wasn't like someone sent it to you. You stumbled across it and you're reading it and you're thinking in your head, there's no way this is true. There's just no way. There's just no way. I mean, I had the same thought, you know, in the fall when people were telling me, hey, there are legislators that are, you know, taking money and changing laws. No way. Hey, we defeated all that stuff. Jim Black went to jail for it. Why would Republicans be doing that? I don't know. Well, they're doing it. And sure enough, the proof's there. It's not like it's up to opinion. There are members of our General Assembly doing stuff like that. I just couldn't believe it. I just don't want to believe it. A public high school. I even as I read this to you, it's hard to believe. And it's in Maryland, so it's not North Carolina, thank goodness. But it could happen easily in North Carolina. A public high school has been accused of radical Islamic indoctrination by forcing children to profess the Muslim statement of faith, ordering them to memorize the five pillars of Islam, and teaching that the faith of a Muslim is stronger than the average Christian, according to a federal lawsuit filed Wednesday. Thomas More Law Center filed the lawsuit on behalf of John and Melissa Wood. They accused La Plata High School in Maryland of subjecting their teenage daughter to Islamic indoctrination, gosh, struggling with words, English language optional, and propaganda. And when Mr. Wood complained, the school banned him from their campus. Defendants forced Wood's daughter to disparage her Christian faith by reciting the Shahada and acknowledging Muhammad as her spiritual leader, Thomas Moore President Richard Thompson said. The Shahada is the Islamic creed. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. The Thomas Moore Law Center said that for non-Muslims, reciting the statement is sufficient to convert one to Islam. The course also taught false statements such as Allah is the same God worshipped by Christians and Islam is a religion of peace, Thompson said. Good grief. Sounds like somebody turned La Plata High School into a taxpayer-funded madrasa. A spokesperson for Charles County Public Schools told the author of this article that they have not seen the lawsuit and didn't have a comment. Also named as defendants were the Charles County Board of Education principal, Evelyn Arnold, and vice principal, Sharon Morris. The lawsuit filed in federal court alleges that students spent only one day studying Christianity, but 2 weeks studying Islam. During its brief instruction on Christianity, defendants failed to cover any portions of the Bible or other non-Islamic religious texts, such as the Ten Commandments, the lawsuit states. Instead, the class included disparaging remarks about Christianity and the Pope. Students were also allegedly instructed that, quote, the Islamic religion is a fact while Christianity and Judaism are just beliefs, end quote. Such discriminatory treatment of Christianity is an unconstitutional promotion of one religion over another, Thompson said. United States Supreme Court precedent does not create a double standard that allows for the promotion of Islam in our public schools while disallowing and silencing teachers of Christianity and Judaism, the lawsuit states. According to copies of classroom assignments, the school taught that, quote, most Muslim faith is stronger than the average Christian. So those are in the documents from the school to the kids. They also instructed students that Islam is a peaceful religion and they treated conquered nations with kindness and respect. On a side note, I'm sure there are plenty of Syrian and Iraqi Christians who would love to weigh in on that classroom lesson. The school also served as apologists for the Islamic faith, according to a handout titled Islam Today. Nowhere in the Quran does it say you will go to paradise if you martyr yourself with a suicide bomb, the handout stated. Important, the majority of Muslims do not live this way. The school also instructed students on jihad, a holy war waged on behalf of Islam as a spiritual religious duty, a personal struggle and devotion to Islam, especially involving spiritual discipline. Wow. It allegedly occurred last year. And by the way, the guy, the parent that's involved in this lawsuit is a Marine veteran. And he did call the school and have some alarm over his daughter's assignments. He requested his daughter be allowed to opt out of the lesson and given an alternative assignment. The following day, the vice principal told Wood that his daughter was required to take the class and would receive zeros on any incomplete assignments, even if the assignment violated their religious beliefs and heritage. So there you go. Never happens in school, does it? That's the thing. You can't believe that it's happening. I remember last year in North Carolina, in Cary, in Wake County, students were taught, you know, how do you interpret this from Sharia law? If you were making it, they would give them these situations and then ask the students to interpret it based on Sharia law. I actually called one of the teachers and they claimed, hey, we're just spending some time looking at different things. It didn't seem all that harmful, but I'm sure if most parents were paying attention, they would probably be upset about it. Because you don't know. People don't a lot of times. Unfortunately, our schools become more glorified daycare centers, and that's just unfortunate. That's just really, really unfortunate. Astounding. This is the kind of stuff when you look overall, you can't believe. It's like, okay, here's the part I don't get. I get that you want to have well-informed students. I just don't know why, who looks at a lesson plan like that and says, we need to do this. There's no reason in the world you can't teach a course on comparative religion and faith. There's no reason in the world you can't teach that. But to make people recite oaths and the parts of faith, Christian or otherwise, you should just not. You can say these are what they believe and this is what this believes, and you need to have, you know, I think it's great to have discussions about that. I think it's great for folks to be informed. But I mean, some of the stuff you have to wonder, when teachers look at this, what goes through their mind to say, yeah, you know what, this is what I'm going to teach, and not think that it's going to be controversial? Or maybe they see their way of looking at the world is, hey, that they want to be controversial. They want to get attention. They want to do something. I don't know. I'm just, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you, me, everyone, when I give speeches around the state, some of the questions I get is, why does it matter? It matters. If things didn't matter, then we'd still be British citizens. If things didn't matter, we would not have had a horrific period of history called the Civil War. If things didn't matter, we wouldn't have called it World War I, II, Vietnam, Korea. If things didn't matter, we wouldn't work diligently to get out of recessions and depressions. It does matter. Life matters. Freedom matters. It isn't free. It comes at a great price. And we in North Carolina, we are blessed with many, many things. We have amazing geography, just astounding culture, so many things to see, do, be a part of. We have some freedoms. If we don't cherish them, if we don't look after them, they will be taken away from us, not just by Democrats, but by Republicans as well. The elite class, those, when they get in office, sometimes they forget from whence they come. It is your job. You have an obligation to watch what they do. And regardless of which district you're in, let me remind you, and I can't recall who said it, but the government doesn't. You should not be afraid of your government. You should not be afraid of your elected leaders. They should be afraid of you. They aren't better than they think they're better than. They're not. They're not smarter than you. They're not better than you. They work for you. Folks, have a great weekend. We'll be back bright and early on Monday. Take care.